Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte. Episode 39 for February 8th, 2012. Gina Trapani. Triangulation is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we bring in somebody really cool, really awesome, really wonderful, and Tom and I grill them until they burst into tears. It's so much fun. Tom Merritt is here, the host of TNT, Frame Rate, Forecast, Sword and Laser Pointer. And there's something else, isn't there?
East meets West.
You still do that with Roger? Meets West, or as I call it, because I think it's a food podcast. Eats meets West.
Then we get sued by Food TV. So we,
Oh, all right. Do they have a show called?
They have a show called East Meets West.
Oh,
maybe we should call ours.
You should call it Eats Meets West,
and then sue them.
It's kind of silly. So, by the way, February 22nd, we're booked, which is 2 weeks hence, for Steve Martin. We'll be joining us for an hour. That's
looking
exciting.
Forward to that.
This week, I forget that some of the smartest, most wonderful people, the kind of people that you would die to interview, are regulars on our shows. And so we forget that they're so special. And I can remember being so in awe of our guest for many, many years. And when we started to do a show about Google, I thought, who would, if it were the dream team, who would I get? And I thought, Jeff Jarvis and today's guest. Jeff's already been on the show, Gina Trapani. And I thought, we'll never get Gina. And I had a producer call you, and she said, oh, yeah, Gina's very interested. I said, what? That's fantastic.
That was a good call.
Gina Trapani, it's so great to have you.
Meaning and it was a good phone call.
It only took me 100 episodes of Twig to learn how to pronounce your name, so I call her Trapani for the first 100 episodes.
Trapani and Trapani are both perfectly acceptable. I happen to say Trapani, but Trapani's okay. So that's why I didn't correct you. People said to me, why did you let Leo say Trapani for so long? And it's really okay. If you said Trapini, I would have corrected you.
I'll tell you why. Because Gina's one of the nicest people in the world. And I'm so thrilled that we can get you on Triangulation. Because actually, I only know a little bit of your story, and I want to get the whole thing. Now, Tom's been doing an amazing amount of research.
In a way, I sort of have, because I fell in love with Gina Trapani when I mispronounced her name. when I started reading you on Lifehacker, I had no idea who you were, what you sounded like, what you looked like, anything else. But I kept going to Lifehacker and seeing these amazing articles from the same person over and over. And I would steal from you blindly for my CNET how-tos.
We all did.
I'd always give credit. I was like, hey, check out Gina Trapani's Lifehacker article if you want to see more. But and so when the first time I heard you come on TWiT, I was like, oh, so that's who she is. That's amazing. So I've been a big fan for a long time.
She's fantastic.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. I'm an introvert. I really kind of detest public speaking. So when I got the call to be on TWiT, I was so conflicted, because I was like, God, I'm going to be so bad at this, but these people are so great and I can't possibly say no. And I remember actually the first time that I was on TWiT, which was on actually This Week in Tech, a Sunday, I was a guest. And I'm sure that I didn't say very much, because I think I was just so nervous about it. But doing TWiG the past, God, it's been 2 years now, has been such an incredible opportunity. And I feel so honored to be here with you today on Triangulation and just part of the network in general. I mean, you just don't get opportunities to work with people who are so good at what they do and such professionals. So I wanted to thank you. I mean, I hid behind my name. I barely even published pictures of myself online for many years, especially in the beginning of Lifehacker, because I just am just naturally kind of shy and introverted. So I thank you for giving me, a platform. Not at Lifehacker anymore, but TWiG is such a great platform, and it's great to be here today. So,
well, yeah, you're now. I mean, your face is known. You're a celebrity. You came out of
the
shell.
Really,
you came out of your shell. Yeah, that's great. I'm thrilled we can get you out of your shell. How did Lifehacker come about?
It started in 2004 when Getting Things Done, which is David Allen's productivity book, which is really a book written for corporate guys in suits who push paper and have secretaries. That was really the target audience, kind of executives. Kind of took hold in the geek community, and this idea of life hacks was born. Actually, Danny O'Brien, who would be great guest for Triangulation someday, had done a talk at an O'Reilly conference called Life Hacks, the Productivity Secrets of Alpha Geeks. Mm. And I was just, I love this idea. Cory Doctorow, I wasn't actually at the conference, but Cory Doctorow had taken notes. And I just love this idea that there are all these geeks who had had these secret scripts and like text files stowed away in all these cool places, you know, to kind of automate their workflow. I just love the idea as a programmer. I was a programmer at the time that you could kind of program your own productivity methodology. So I was really in love with this life hacks idea. And at the time I was doing some consulting work for Nick Denton, a product that he was building at the time, Kinja, which is no longer around. So I was a developer for him and he was building up the Gawker Media kind of group of weblogs. And so he and I started talking about the idea of doing a life hacker site. And I really love the idea because at the time, now this is 2004, back then, like the big tech blogs were basically Slashdot and Gizmodo.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like all the tech sites were really focused on like shiny new gadgets. And I really wanted to write a site. And this is in the time of like the dawn of Gmail and the cloud and web apps really kind of coming into their own. And I wanted to do a site that was about productivity and software and utility, like this kind of intersection of self-help and the way that technology can help you get things done versus just sort of like worship of CPU cycles and memory capacity and that kind of thing. So that's how Lifehacker started. I launched it as a Gawker site, which is interesting because most of the Gawker sites are basically gossip sites. So,
well, except for Gizmodo.
Right,
except for Gizmodo. But even Gizmodo has kind of a tabloidy feel to it sometimes.
It's gotten more so, actually. It's
actually
interesting.
Actually more so. Yeah. So my goal was like within this giant network of sites that basically cover gossip, I want to be kind of this helpful, friendly, informative how-to site. And that worked really well for a while, and it's done really well since. I was there from 2005 until 2009.
Did you have ownership of it? Did you sell it? What happened?
No. I was just the founding editor, so I was the sole blogger, and I was the editor. But Gawker owned the site, and they paid me a salary to run the site. So
God, I just feel like you were so much more than just the editor. It was like you. And there were how many Lifehacker books? Three?
Yeah, there have been three editions of the Lifehacker book. And, you know, Nick gave me a lot of control about what the persona of the site would be like. And in fact, you know, all the sites back then had this like mascot. So we sketched out what this personality was going to be. It was very intentionally a female voice.
Oh, interesting.
And kind of a female personality.
That's interesting. I didn't realize
because
that.
I felt like most tech sites have this kind of male voice and this take, this kind of like showmanship and one-upmanship, right, and this kind of like, you know, put down kind of feeling, this hard edge to it. And I didn't want it to be like, you know, I didn't want to write a site about pink iPhone covers with jewels stuck to it. There was going to be no pink anywhere. I didn't want it feminine in that kind of way. But I wanted it to be, you know, women, I think, and I'm making a very big generalization here, so forgive me for that. But I think that women tend to, you know, worship the shiny new gadgets less, mm-hmm, and just want to know what can these things do for us? You know, what's the utility? And that's what I wanted to focus on, this kind of productivity, self-help, you know, what can this stuff do for us? And I'm also just generally more passionate about software than I am about hardware, coming from a developer background.
It's interesting because that was kind of the distinction between screensavers and call for help. We didn't
tools
think it was gender.
Toys.
But yeah, I was screensavers was for the tech enthusiast who was really interested in the toys aspect of it and the gadgets. Mm-hmm. And call for help was a tools show, how to get the most out of what you've got. So they're really there. I believe there really is that distinction. I'm not sure it's gender based, but I often
they had overlap audience, but they also had distinct.
Well, and
audiences.
It was 98% male. So we definitely weren't winning women by doing that. But yeah. I think that I always thought of it is, it was like you were baby ducks imprinted. You know how baby ducks are imprinted on their mom at birth? Conrad Lawrence very famously led his baby ducks around because they thought he was their mom. I think that people get imprinted by the computer technology they first use. So if the first encounter with computers is video games, it will always be a toy for you, something that you can be enthusiastic about. Mm-hmm. And if it was at work using Microsoft Word or Excel, then it will always be a tool for you. And I think that almost imprints you for life.
What was the first technology that you got imprinted by, Gina?
Oh, that's a really good question. Well, my dad bought an IBM PC Junior when I was 9. So I was in fourth grade. And that was my first like computer. I always loved technology and gadgets. Like I remember, you know, the Light Bright was a big deal when I got that for Christmas.
Now that's girly.
I love Legos. Like I
The
love,
Light Bright, you know. Is it girly? This is young. It's just kiddie.
It, it was like you plugged it in and it lit up. That's cool. I mean, it's got Arduino.
Artie? Okay, Artie. I'll give you Artie.
But that PC Junior was my first computer, and that's when I programmed. I started writing BASIC on that. In like third or fourth grade. So that was a hugely empowering kind of experience for me. It was funny, you know, I was really into computers during middle school and elementary school, and then I got to high school. I went to an all girls Catholic high school and didn't take one computer class, like just completely fell off my radar. Tech completely fell off my radar. Wasn't involved in computers at all. I took a keyboarding class, which was basically a typing class, which was Latin were the two most useful classes that I took in high school. Oh, yes, Latin, Catholic, Brooklyn.
Why was Latin useful?
Because as a writer, Latin's really, really useful.
I mean, I'm with you.
Vocabulary and...
Totally agree with you.
It's a word.
Just the other day, I was talking to Kat, who's a classic scholar over at the coffee place that we go, Acre Coffee, and I told her, Omnes Gallia in partes tres divisa est, and she couldn't have agreed more.
Is she really a classic scholar?
Yeah, she and her husband both, which is why they work at coffee shops. But that's another story entirely.
Yes.
You love Latin, too. I think that Latin is a very geeky thing to love.
It is. Well, it's a really pretty geeky language. I mean, it's a dead language, so you're talking about, you know, fields and animals and, you know.
And it has a very strict, I feel like it's similar to programming.
It is.
Because of its strictness. Rigid. Its rigidity, yeah.
Conjugation, yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So when did you start programming? Did you program in high school?
No, not at all. I got to college and I was going to be an English major. I was going to be a poet. I was going to change the world with my work. I was going to like write the great American novel and be, you know, this amazing writer. But I was broke and I didn't have a car and I was in a long distance relationship and I couldn't pay my phone bill. So I had to get a job on campus. And the only jobs available on campus were at the computer lab help desk. So I said to them, I don't really know anything about computers. It's been years. And they're like, well, we'll train you. And I absolutely just fell in love. I went to Marist College, which is in Poughkeepsie, New York, which is where IBM is headquartered. So Marist had this partnership with IBM. So we had this giant IBM mainframe and all these OS2 machines.
Wow.
And then Windows machines.
OS2 machines. That's awesome.
I know. It was a long time ago. And so I wound up declaring computer science minor, and I wound up, you know, managing the computer lab by my senior year. And I'm an introvert, as I said, so like I wanted to get away from my roommate as much as possible. And there was this office in the computer lab with a door with a lock. And as a manager, I had access to that room, and it had two computers in it. So, you know, this is a time when people didn't have computers in their dorm rooms generally. So I would just go to the lab, and it was open 24 hours, and I would just be in that room alone, just making web pages and doing my Pascal homework and chatting in IRC. And it was truly, you know, a room of one's own. That was my room, and I think that really changed things for me.
So you crossed through the intersection of arts and sciences.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's really interesting. That is such a shift from poet to, that's a king geek. You know, that's what the MIT hackers were doing. They locked themselves in there and they were, that's really interesting.
Yeah, my senior thesis was like hypertext fiction. You know, it was like a website where you could kind of choose your own adventure. So I'd write the various storylines and then you could branch off. And then I realized that it was an enormous writing assignment because the more branches, the more possibilities.
You have to write all the answers. That's right.
Hypertext was like very mind-blowing, mind-blowing technology back then. I saw web time in that lab on Mosaic and I was like, at first, I didn't get it. I was like, what is this French guy's resume doing on this computer in Poughkeepsie? Like, I don't understand.
Do you think that because you were a writer, you approach technology in a different way?
I hope so. I mean, I try to approach programming and just software development in general as an expression of,
it's
not
poetry.
A story, then an expression of values, you know, kind of...
Yeah.
You know, tackling a problem or trying to. I mean, with a story or a poem, you're trying to evoke a feeling. You're trying to get a message across. I think the same is very true with software, but at a pretty high level. I mean, the reality is that writing code is very different than writing prose. Although, you know, sometimes I try to get poetic in my comments.
Do you really? Does anybody see your comments? I mean, are your comments private? Nobody sees them.
Well, most of the projects that I work on are open source, I try to comment pretty liberally.
Oh, now I
use you comment in Latin.
I'm going to check.
I don't comment in Latin.
Now I'm going to go to Subversion and check out Think Up app so I can...
I mean, there's a really, it's really interesting, especially doing coding open source, because you know that your source code is going to be out there, and you know, just coming up with the few lines that describe the method that you're writing, you have to come up with a headline or a description that very clearly communicates to someone, a programmer who's never seen this before and is not in your head, to get what are you trying to do, and it really makes you crystallize what you're trying to do. So I'm a big believer in commenting. I'm a big believer in coding in public because it makes you write for other programmers who are going to have to read and understand what you're doing. So that's part of the reason why I do most of my work, my open source work. You know, it's open source, so it's public by default. But I do it in public because it forces me to do better at it or to try harder.
It does seem like a perfect match to end up doing something like Lifehacker. I mean, in retrospect, sometimes these things always seem fated, but you had the perfect skill. You had training in communication and explaining things, and you had training in how things work under the hood. And that's usually the problem engineers have and programmers have, is how do I explain this to somebody who doesn't understand it? And it's a rare skill to be able to bridge that gap.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think this is why Leo and you are so successful, because you are able to communicate very technical issues, you know, in simple language. I mean, my favorite thing to do at Lifehacker was to just, you know, flesh out just a long, you know, a how-to, a step-by-step how-to with details. You know, here's how you do this. You know, installing a web server on your desktop computer, that sounds crazy and geeky and scary, but here are the things that you can do with it, and here's the way that you can do it, and it's you know, it's not that hard, and here are the screenshots. And I got a lot of satisfaction from explaining those kinds of things and those kind of how-to features. That stuff, it still comes up in my Google search results. That stuff does great SEO wise as sites like eHowKnow. And it was one of the more successful kind of parts about Lifehacker, much more successful than the 200 word, you know, soundbite about, right, you know, the day's news.
No, that's what I love about Geeks. It's very concrete. Just show me how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Don't wax philosophical. Although Twig is the most philosophical show we do, but really, I like that. Now, how much time do you spend writing prose, and how much time coding? You code every day now?
I'm primarily coding every day. So my primary job is working on ThinkUp, which is, I'd say that's probably 80% of my time. And I'm also build to-do manager a task manager app for iOS and Android. So I build the to-do text apps. I build ThinkUp. I work on some Firefox extensions, and I'm working on a Chrome extension now. So most of my time I'm coding now. The only writing that I'm doing right now is documentation for ThinkUp and my personal blog, which doesn't get updated nearly as much as Lifehacker did. You know, I kind of burned out a little bit at Lifehacker. I was there for 4 years, and we were publishing 20 posts a day. I started alone, doing 12 posts a day alone.
Holy cow.
I nearly wound up in a straitjacket. We hired an editorial team. And that, as you both know, it's just a grind, you know? Yeah. It's a grind to get out fresh new content every single day.
Especially step-by-step stuff.
Yes.
Where you have to be correct.
And screenshots.
You have to double-check. You have to put in screenshots. You have to do it more than once. Make sure that you're saying it right. You know, it's much easier to go, yeah, this new camera looks like crap. Here are the specs.
Right.
Post.
Right.
I'm not belittling gadget blogging, but I you know, fundamentally, there's a difference between the two.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I got to this place where I was just like, I'm a developer. There are so many cool things happening in tech space right now. I spend all day writing about all the cool things that other people are doing. And deep down, I kind of fancy myself a maker. I wanted to be out there making stuff. So I made this big shift, I think, after Lifehacker, after 20,000 posts on Lifehacker. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go make stuff. I'm going to go write code instead of prose. So I'm in the coding part of my brain for the past couple of years. I'm sure I'll swing back to writing maybe a little more later.
I went to my ThinkUp homepage to look at the source code, but there's not a lot of comments there, so I didn't find anything philosophical.
You know, it's so funny. You and I are both doing that. I'm looking through the PHP code and...
More on the PHP side than
There's more opportunity for comments.
This is all on GitHub, not Subversion, but it's all open and stuff. But the comments... looking for poetry, Gina. I'm looking for a haiku or two.
Where's your sonnet? There, in the license.
Yeah.
It's the GNU GPL V2.
In iambic pentameter.
I love it.
Really?
I do find that very interesting, because the kind of nexus between poetry writing and coding. Of course, coding is a much more rigid thing. But it is an art, and it is a syntax, and it is a communication, and the greatest coders all kind of say, oh, no, don't think of it as instructions for the machine. Think of it as a syntax for talking about problems.
Yes.
And stuff like that. And that it is feels very poetic when you read the Lisp books and things like that, that that's really what they're thinking about. It's not, here's step-by-step instructions, like Lifehacker, here's step-by-step instructions for a machine to do something. It isn't. It's a syntax for describing problems and their solutions. It was, wow, that's interesting. It's expressive.
It is.
So when you say... at Vara test CRSF token. You really feel it. You feel it in your heart there, deep, deep, deep down.
I take my CSRF tokens very seriously.
Well, there is a similarity between poetry and code in that poetry is forcing the language into a form, right?
Yes.
Quite often.
It's very structured.
Yeah.
The sonnet, you got very strict syntax rules. So you also, and I'm looking at smarterware.org, which is Gina's blog, and besides, okay, so you just heard all the different things she's doing. Oh, yeah, and by the way, she has a little Android open source free app called To-Do Text, which actually came out of a bash script.
A shell
script that was a text-based to-do list. Mm-hmm. Which I love, and I love to do text, and you've kind of made it now more friendly because you've got a GUI on top of it and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you must like development. I mean, you do this for fun, I guess.
I do. It's actually a little bit of a problem that the thing that I do for work is also kind of the thing that I do for play.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things about doing Lifehacker is that I was writing about how great plain text is, like as a storage format, because it's cross-platform and every text editor on the sun can edit it. And then I was like, I'm just gonna switch to To-Do Text. And so I wrote that little bash script. And I have this great community at Lifehacker of people, many engineers who kind of took it over, and the shell script really expanded and got all kinds of new functionality. And then we're like, well, if you store it in Dropbox, it was this project that started in 2006 and just blossomed over time. And now there's a native app for Android and a native app for iOS.
So great.
Which is a lot of fun.
And you have 17 contributors.
The Android version, that's my contributor list in the Android version, which has been great.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the really great benefits about having a platform like Lifehacker or like Twig is that you get people who are interested in your work, and if you open source it, you have people who know a lot more than you do come on in and look at what you're doing and make suggestions and contribute code. And GitHub is such a great, great tool for collaboration doing that. So really, couldn't these apps wouldn't have happened without community contributions.
You are now doing an iOS version, which I thought was very surprising.
Yes. The iOS version just came out last month, actually. And I've been an Android user for 3 years. And the reason why I did the iOS version was for a few reasons. First of all, it was like very just highly requested. A lot of people who used the shell script and liked the Android app wanted an iOS version. And also, I just wanted to understand Apple's development guidelines and their approval process, and I wanted to understand at a very intimate level what the different interaction models for the iPhone iOS was over Android. I hadn't had an iPhone since 08, so since like the first iPhone. So I've gone back to iOS just recently to dog food the app, and I wanted to get a better understanding of what that was like. And also, truthfully, I was curious to know if iOS apps truly do sell so much better than Android.
Yeah, we'll find out, because it's $1.99 on iOS.
Mm-hmm.
And how much is it the same on Android?
$2 on Android.
$2
yep.
on Android. Okay.
Well, and there is a whole lot different perspective that you have when you critique these things like app rejection policies and how the different stores work, that you can't have a perspective in the same way if you're not actually doing it, if you're not actually living it.
Yep. That's absolutely true. Yeah, I'm constantly having this kind of Twitter debate with Marco, who does this incredible iOS app for Instapaper, Marco Arment, yeah, but why there isn't one for Android, and why the ones for Android, which are third party, aren't as good as the ones he's made for iOS. And he was always just like, this isn't right for my business. I'm not the time isn't gonna, the investment isn't going to be worth the return. And so with To Do Text, I wanted to see, if that would be true. And
it's too early to tell, probably.
It's too early to tell, but honestly, so far, the iOS app has sold much better than the Android app. And I think part of that is that I think the Android app has been out for a year, so people were kind of clamoring for it and waiting for it. And I think people are just more willing and more prepared to spend money on the iOS platform because iTunes has their credit card already, and it's a one-tap deal.
It's not a fair test, though, because To Do Text is such a geeky Android-y kind of a thing because it's a text, flat file text database that you parse to get a GUI, but it's still text. You keep it in your Dropbox. You can access it with Bash scripts on all your, on your Mac or on your Linux box. People use it on Windows too. They, I guess they.
We had a community member make us a GUI for Windows, and we had a community member make a Windows Phone 7 version. So it's actually the format has gotten a little.
So I would almost be surprised if it did well on the iOS side. It just feels geekier than that.
It's very, very geeky. It's a very niche thing. It's extremely geeky. Yeah. I mean, just setting it up is you really kind of have to be committed to an open format and to text.
I love it because you can use Quicksilver to update it. It's very Merlin Man, you know.
It is. And it's not anything I'm going to get rich doing, but it was a really fun exercise in creating native mobile apps.
How difficult is it to take an app written for Android and then take it to iOS? Because you hear a lot about the, you know, write once, publish everywhere systems.
Mm-hmm.
Can't use those on iOS.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are things like PhoneGap that you can create an app and then generate a native app on both platforms. I wanted to have the native local development experience, so I did, you know, the Android app in Java and the iOS app in Objective-C. And, you know, it's difficult insofar as that you have to rewrite all of your classes. You know, it's a completely different language, and there are definitely some interaction differences. You know, like on iOS, you can swipe a list item to complete it. Android doesn't have that. You know, Android has things like widgets and share menu integration. But the overall design, if you design your app well, your object structure and your data structure are the same. So it's just porting those things over to the different language. So I would say it's moderately difficult. I mean, I didn't get as familiar with Objective-C as I would have liked. Really, I had this great developer kind of take over the development of that app.
Okay.
And I just sort of facilitated it for him and was
if you like Pascal, you'll love Objective-C.
Yeah. But it was worth the experience of like what do you have to do to see a native app through to the App Store.
That's, by the way, this is a couple of things I love about Gina. A, you're not a dogmatist, and so there's plenty of people who would say, oh no, I'm like a Marco, frankly. Oh no, I won't go there. And there are plenty of Android people who do the same to iOS. And you're very open, and I like your experimental point of view. I want to ask you about ThinkUp. Because that's been big, and the White House got involved, and now you work for Expert Labs, Neil Dash's company. We've had Anil on the show. There's lots more to talk about, and I don't know how personal you want to get, but we could talk about Prop 8, too, which just got overturned by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and I'm sure that you have an opinion on that.
Mm-hmm.
Or you might. I just remember last year. Just a little bit. But before we do, and I know you have opinion on this too, let's talk a little bit about Audible.com, my favorite place to go for audiobooks. We're all Audible fans here. And I know when you and Veronica do Sword and Laser, you always look for Audible versions. Because some people, that's a tough show because you have lots to read.
We've been going through the debate that you've already been through on Twit of, is it reading a book to listen?
Yes, it's reading a book.
And yes. And you know who wins that argument? The blind people. When they write in and are like,
am I reading?
I'm reading a book. Okay, so shut up.
It's all the same words.
It's a different way of absorbing it, et cetera, et cetera. But we're reading Rule 34 by Charles Stross.
Perfect.
Right now.
Oh, I want it.
But you know.
That's interesting.
It's a great book. It took me a little while to get into it. But the idea is there's in the not too distant future in Scotland, there's a section of the police dedicated to investigating internet crimes. And one of the big internet crimes is unlicensed fabs. 3D printers have become so widespread that you have to have a license to properly run them you're not ripping off companies for their designs.
Oh, I love that. Rule 34. Now, here's the deal. We're going to show you. I'm going to tell you a way you can get one book free. Now, this is, of course, a challenge because Audible.com has 100,000 titles, and there are so many great books. I spent so much time listening. I'm listening to the great Stephen King book, 1122-63, which is fantastically read. We talked about the performance, just amazing performance. But then Game of Thrones, or The Song of Ice and Fire, Clash of Kings is coming. And this is an example, and I'm sure you've talked about this in Sword and Laser, where I really feel like you should listen to the book first and not watch the show. Not merely because it'll help you understand the show, because the show moves, but because I think the book experience is the best We were talking about this the other day, and I thought, you know, I think really the rule of thumb, I'd say, is the original format is the best. So if it's 2001, you could watch the movie or read the book because they were written created simultaneously. If it's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, listen to the radio show first, then read the book. But I think if it's A Song of Ice and Fire, you got to read the book before you watch it on HBO. I'm sure it's going to be great. So you got about a month, right? It's April.
Yeah. Yeah, it's coming April 1st.
So
winter is coming.
You got 6 weeks.
Winter is coming.
So I got to say, if you haven't yet read any of A Song on Ice and Fire, you've got some...
Those are usually 2-credit books.
Are they?
Yeah. I'm afraid.
Oh, that would be terrible.
Because they're so huge.
They're, 37 hours. How can you tell? Is it say on here somewhere? Like, this is 2 credits?
When you're logged in.
I am logged in.
It should say it, yeah.
See, I already own it. That's part of the reason it probably doesn't say it.
Right.
So, okay, well, if it's 2 credits, you can't have it. You can only get a 1-credit book. Most of these books are 1-credit. I just think you really want to listen to this. So I'll tell you what, make that be your next thing.
Game of Song of Ice and Fire, 2 credits, 2 credits.
All right. Let's go back to Rule 34 or the Stephen King book. Most of the books are single credit.
Stephen King book's a great one,
too. It's really good, and the reader's good. And I don't know how it ends. Don't say. I'm starting to wonder, but it's just fantastic performance. That's actually,
well, you know how it's supposed to.
I know it's supposed to. I don't know how it's going. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And so one of the things that's really interesting about listening, Audible adds one more thing that you don't normally think about in a book, which is how it's read, how it's performed, and the performances in here are fantastic. That's a particularly good performance by Craig Wasson, the actor Craig Wasson. He brings those characters to life. And I do think that's a little different than reading a book because they're speaking to you. You're there.
Now, there's no argument that you get a different experience, but you still, in the end, have read the book, I feel like.
I got one for you. If you're going to go see Abe Lincoln, Vampire Hunter.
That's a good one. That's a great one.
You should probably read the book first, right?
Yes.
I hope they have it. I didn't check. Abe Lincoln... Vampire.
See, the problem is we could do this all day.
Because
reminded me that Ian Tregellis' new book is out on Audible first. Not in print till the summer,
isn't that interesting?
On Audible, yeah.
That's happening more and more. And, of course, because publishers realize audio is so valuable to the book, they often are publishing the book at the same time as the audio. That's what happened with Baratunde's book. I should really mention Baratunde Thurston's book, How to Be Black, also on Audible. See, we've just given you like 20 credits worth of books. And I'm going to give you one.
Free.
You get one free. Audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. Go there. Sign up. You're going to sign up for the gold account. So what it is, it's a credit a month. And your first month is free. So that means your first credit's free. So the first book is free if it's a 1-credit book, which Vampire Hunter is. And you quit at any time. You don't have to pay anything. It's yours to keep. I think you're going to want to stick around, though, because it really, as you can see. And the thing about Audible is it's a way to read when you don't have time anymore in your life. To read. We don't have that luxury. But are you at the gym? Are you in the car commuting or carpooling or driving the kids?
Do you need to vacuum?
You got to vacuum.
This will help you do it.
Got to do laundry. I'll tell you what, laundry never went so fast, so easy as when you got something like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter in your ear. Audible.
Life hack.
Life. Oh, wait a minute. Your book's on there, right? Is it?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure.
No, they wouldn't read that. You couldn't because they couldn't follow the steps. You go, wait a minute. Slow down. That wouldn't work. Computer books, they do not have. I have to admit this. They have business books, the Steve Jobs book, stuff like that. But computer books, it's a little hard to
follow. It doesn't quite translate well to audio.
So they don't have the Life Hacker books at all. Sorry. But they do have plenty of other great books. 100,000 titles at audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. Plays on your iPhone, your iPod, all the Android stuff. I use the Audible app on Android or iPhone, and I highly recommend it. Audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. There are very good self-help books, audiobooks. I love Dr. Weil's stuff is great on here. Wayne Dyer has a bunch of stuff. In fact, some of his, you know, because he gives seminars, some of his seminars are on here, and I just love listening to them. There's a lot of self-help stuff on here. There's a whole Wayne Dyer audio collection. We are talking to Gina Trapani. She is the founding editor of Life Hacker, a programmer who has written tons of software, including her most recent, which is ThinkUp. What is ThinkUp?
ThinkUp is an installable web application that captures all of your social media activity across networks. So Facebook, Twitter, Google+. It archives all your status updates and all the replies to those status updates and your links and your favorites and your friends and your followers. and it makes really cool charts, and it helps you search your archives over the past few years and just get deeper insights into that activity. It's actually, right now, the state that it's in, we just released our 1.0 release, which is our first kind of big stable release. And it's really, it's a seedling of my kind of grand vision for what I want for it to be. But it, you know, and there are a lot of hurdles right now. You have to install it on a web server that has PHP similar to WordPress. And you know, we're still adding support for different networks. But it's, I was saying earlier that I think that software is this, you know, it is an expression of values, right? So for me, like ThinkUp is an expression of three really important things to me. First is the idea that you should be able to archive, capture, and control your own data. I mean, right now, if you have tweeted more than 3,200 times, and I've been pumping data into Twitter every day practically since 2007, you can't search back and get your tweets. There's just an API limit on how many tweets you can get back, mostly because Twitter's business model is to be kind of the pulse of the planet at the moment, but they don't kind of respect archives as much. So you can't get your data out. So ThinkUp helps you keep your data, and not only your own posts, but things that other people have responded to. So controlling your own data, getting insights from your own data, because lots of advertising companies are getting insights from your own data, from your data. So I feel like you should be able to get those insights as well.
So Gina very kindly set me up with... Go ahead, I'll let you get to the second thing in a second, but this is what it looks like. I'm not running the server. Gina's letting me use her server. So these are recent posts. Here's a graph of activity. The dark ones are retweets. The light ones are replies. The most replied to posts for this week, followers by day, followers by week, the week's most retweeted client usage.
See, you're a broadcaster. I'm a conversationalist.
Shut up. I don't want to hear from you. I just want to talk.
I'm just telling you.
Leo is a natural broadcaster.
My most replied to tweet of all time is 987 replies, 18. So this is, and as an example, Steve Martin, who came to me and said, I need a way to do archive not only all my tweets, because he knew about this problem, but all the replies. Because
yeah.
I may someday want to do a book. And, you know, he's using Twitter in a really unique way. He's actually writing comedy in 140
yes.
characters.
And he's doing an incredible job of it. He's hilarious.
It's so funny.
No, it's super. Mm-hmm. During the Super Bowl, he was at his top four. It was really
so
good.
I connected and hooked him up with Gina. And I presume that the book, which is coming out on the 21st, will give you a big dang acknowledgement, I hope.
I hope so. Fingers crossed on that.
Yeah, Steve's going to join us in 2 weeks and to talk about that book.
You know, it's just been fun watching ThinkUp grow. I think I've been on since like the 0.3 version.
Old school.
Yeah, and it is just, you know, and it was useful then. It was great then, but it's just amazing how polished it has become and the extra things that you've added.
It's very elegant.
Follower counts, all of the depth, the predictions of when you'll reach certain milestones in your follower counts. I love that. The most discerning followers section is kind of fun for a vanity search. It's just there's so much useful and entertaining, and sometimes both, information that I get out of it.
See, this is interesting. I don't know if you should tell Jeff this, but he's a deadbeat.
Is he?
Just I got Chatterbox's deadbeats popping.
That's a bug because he's pretty. He tweets a lot, so that's got to be a bug. Because the deadbeats list is generally people who are quiet. So yeah. I'm thinking of maybe the crawlers behind on that one.
Kevin Kelly, he's a deadbeat. I tell you, he never tweets. Isn't that funny? So this is.
Yeah, I've got Kevin Kelly there too. That's funny.
Yeah. So very. So this is now the White House. Use this. So, tell us about Expert Labs. Because this is Anil Dash's company. You work for them.
Mm-hmm.
Is ThinkUp a project of Expert Labs?
Yeah, Expert Labs is a small nonprofit that's funded by the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the MacArthur Foundation.
Oh, wow.
And ThinkUp used to be called Twitalytic, and it was just a weekend project. And Anil asked me to come under the Expert Labs umbrella and to use Expert Labs funding to fund its development. So I get paid to develop ThinkUp full-time, which is basically a programmer's dream, you know, to have a weekend project turn into a funded, and not VC-funded, you know, not all the pressures that come with VC funding, but grant-funded open-source project that's there to help our government agencies. So I've been building ThinkUp under the Expert Labs umbrella. And Expert Labs' mission is to help government agencies listen to their constituents on social media more effectively. So we've been working with the White House and several other agencies, the FCC and several others, to capture their social media activity and give them insights into what people are saying, primarily to them. So through mentions and that kind of thing. So, for example, there during the State of the Union address, most places kind of covered what was the SOTU hashtag, what were people saying about the State of the Union. We tracked what were people saying back to at White House and at White House Live, at WH Live, which is the White House's kind of live Twitter handle, during the speech. And we were able to kind of contrast that to what people were just saying about, kind of shouting out into the void about. So we actually Expert Labs put together an infographic describing, you know, some of the White House's activity based on ThinkUp Insight. So That's been really fun. It was very exciting. I mean, it was like one of the most exciting sort of days of my entire life as a programmer was the day when the White House granted, you know, access to ThinkUp, you know, gave ThinkUp its OAuth keys, you know, for us to access their Twitter
amazing.
Account. That felt like that was a really exciting day. Same with Steve Martin and same with you, Leo. So that's been really fun and exciting.
Boy, it sure went off the cliff fast. We had the White House, Steve Martin, Leo. Well, I don't know who this Leo guy is, but thank you. You're very kind to include me in that august roundup.
You know, one of the early design decisions that we made, or that I made with ThinkUp, was this idea that you were going to install it on your own server. And this is something that I feel really strongly about. Like, the thing that I love about the web is that it's a decentralized network of nodes, and I really look forward to the day, and I want to see the day come where each one of us kind of owns our own node and we're able to share
yes.
data peer to peer, right? So that we're not beholden to a company like Twitter or Facebook and what their rules and regs are and their whims about, you know, they're going to take down our profile picture because we decided to flip them the bird or use a name that they didn't like or say something in some country that should be banned. I mean, kind of my vision and my ideal vision is that we all kind of run our own nodes that exchange information peer to peer. We own our own data and make it easy to share with one another. And that might be, you know, an insane, unreachable ideal. Because honestly, right now, setting up a web server and installing a PHP app, it is a complete pain in the rear. And this is part of the reason why ThinkUp doesn't have the kind of users, you know, that I wish that it had. But I think that we can make that kind of deployment of your, you know, nodes that you own easier. And that's something that I want to do with ThinkUp going forward, and so installation and setup and deployment is making that as easy as possible.
Well, it's getting easier and easier. I mean, the WordPress plugin alone was a huge advance that I loved when you did that. But I wanted to hasten to add, when you're talking about all this government stuff, I know there's people who aren't listening closely, like, oh, so the government's going to get all my data. But that's exactly the opposite of the way this works, which
right,
is you
exactly.
are in control of your data. What the White
right.
House is getting is their data.
Right.
Not your
exactly.
data, unless you've made it public on the internet, which
right.
you know, that's your choice to make it public on the internet. But no,
exactly.
I agree with you. I want to see a world where we not only control our own data, but we control our own connections. I mean, I'm hoping that mesh networking someday works out its kinks so that we're not only nodes for data, we're nodes for connectivity, so nobody can control the internet or shut it off at any point.
It's the
exactly.
best hope for freedom. It really is.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, when I look at, you know, there are some great products out there right now that do backup and capture, like Backupify and the Locker Project. These are all great, great projects. But when you're, you know, backing up your data at another central host, you're just sort of like moving, you know, like moving it to, you know, to another place. I mean, you could argue that your web hosting provider then has access to the data that you're
right.
storing in ThinkUp. So, you know, the lines are getting thinner as the lines between sort of the cloud and these different providers, you know, get, you know, are blurred. But I do look forward to a time, first of all, where we don't have to write tools to get the data out that we put into these systems. I mean, it drives me crazy that you're not able to export this stuff and see this stuff just in Twitter. I think Twitter does a great job, and
Does Twitter cooperate with you in any way? I mean, you're not getting the fire hose.
No, we're not getting the fire hose. And in fact, when you set up ThinkUp, you create your own Twitter app and enter the client ID and the client secret into the Twitter. So, like, so we're not even using a single Twitter app. So if Twitter wanted to shut down ThinkUp for breaking their terms of service, which we probably arguably are, they'd have to shut down every single app that has, you know, that users have set up, because each user even controls their own access point.
That was
Twitter.
Kind of the exciting part of setting it up. I was like, ooh, I have an app. I'm a developer.
Is yours still running?
Yeah.
I'm impressed. I could never get mine set up. Jeez, he's good.
Yeah, he is.
Very
good.
I just followed the instructions.
Maybe my server. You did on your Subbrilliant server?
Yeah, I did.
Yours might be better in shape than mine, as I was missing some critical dependencies. So, how do you want to get personal? I don't want to step on any toes.
No, please do. I'm an open book.
So September 19th. No, I'm just kidding.
A day that would live in infamy. Gina is such a sweet person, such a nice person. And there's nobody who couldn't just kind of see Gina and her smiling face and not feel good. Aww. And feel joyous. So I just love talking to her. So there's no deep, dark secrets in her life.
It's nice to be nice, as it says at the bottom of my ThinkUp.
I know, isn't that funny? It's the thing on the bottom of ThinkUp.
It is nice to be nice.
Nice to be nice. That's her. That's her. Let's just show you right there. See, it's nice to be nice.
It is nice to be nice.
So you're gay.
I am.
And you're out, obviously. If you weren't, you are now. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
When did you come out? Was it? Were you young? Were your parents open to the idea? Or?
No. I came out when I was a teenager. I must have been about 16. And I grew up in a pretty Catholic household. I went to an all-girls Catholic school. And I told my parents, and they were both like, oh, no, you're not.
You're mistaken.
You are mistaken. It's just a phase. And then, you know, I went to college and shaved my head and wore freedom rings. And they were kind of like, all right, we believe you. And my parents are fine about it. It took them some time, but they're fine. And they're very, very supportive. And I'm married now. I've been married for 10 years. My wife and I have been together for like 15 years. And yeah. I haven't come out in a long time. I generally just talk about my wife sort of matter-of-factly without being by the way, I'm not heterosexual.
It's so not germane to anything that we've been talking about. And yet I think you agree with me that it's probably a good idea to just say it so that when people see somebody wonderful like Gina, they go, oh, I know a gay person.
And absolutely.
It's not like...
It's something that I'm a pretty private person, probably, I mean, as compared to maybe like Jarvis. But this is something I'm very
yes,
consciously public about, because I feel like everybody benefits by me being public. Yes. My favorite thing is to mention my wife on Twig and see somebody in the chat room say,
whoa,
wait,
did you
she
say
just
wife?
Said her wife?
Yeah,
which
I love
happened
that too.
Just today, yeah. which makes me... And I've gotten such great emails from listeners who said like, oh, it's so good to hear you say that, and I'm gay too, and I've been scared to come out, or I'm gay too, and I have come out, and so I get those kind of stories a lot, which is really great. But
that's important too. We've talked about Dan Savage's campaign, it gets better campaign, and Google's been very much part of that, and mm-hmm. So that's the other side. So there's two messages. There's one to straight people who say, I don't know any gay people, what are they like? No, mm-hmm. You do, and they're great. And then the other would be to teens and young people who you're a role model for so many ways. You're a woman programmer. That's awesome. A woman geek. You're gay. You're a wonderful person. I think it's wonderful to let people know. See, it's okay. Calm down. It's gonna be okay.
Mm-hmm. Me and Kara Switzer.
You're carrying actually more than you and Kara. Believe me.
It's quite
It's quite a cadre actually in tech for some reason.
It's a good community.
I love it. So Prop 8 yesterday passed the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, supported a lower court decision.
To overturn Prop 8.
It didn't pass. Sorry, that's really crazy. To overturn the initiative in California that had overturned the California state law that made gay marriage legal. Are you legally married?
I am legally married.
Why the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned it. They said, you can't do that to people. Let them get married and say, no, you're not married. You can't do that. So you were legally married when the law was first passed in California?
Yeah, I was grandfathered in. I'm the 2008 limited edition, the 9 months that it was legal in 2008. My wife and I got married legally on the courthouse steps the first day that it was legal. It was a wonderful day. We had our commitment ceremony with our family and friends in 2001, and with the dresses and the violins and the whole nine yards. Well, I consider that to be our like real wedding, but I call the marriage that we had at the courthouse in 2008 the legalization. Mm-hmm. And it was obviously really important to us to make it legal, just because, you know, we could, and it's important. And it broke my heart when Prop 8 passed. It absolutely just slayed me. I mean, Obama won and Prop 8 passed, and I was just so bittersweet that night. Yeah. So I was really happy to hear about the decision yesterday. I thought that the wording that that the legislation, that the only purpose of the legislation was to lessen the status of gays and lesbians and to harm them and take away their dignity. That was really strong language. That made me feel really good. But I view these things as kind of battles in a much larger war that's going to go on for many more years and across different states. The president has decided to support equality, but not call it marriage. I mean, he's not trying to let same-sex couples call it marriage. He supports civil unions with all the same rights. So he's basically supporting separate but equal.
Right.
I don't think that that's what he truly believes. I think that he has to choose his battles. And so he's, that's the approach he's decided to take with this one. And that's okay with me, even though I think it's little ironic to go with a separate but equal. But he's got some big issues on his plate, and this is going to happen. It's going to take time. And these, like I said, I'm really happy about the news this past week. And I'm interested to see how it happens. I asked my wife if she would basically marry me in every state that we could.
Oh,
and I think
that's a good idea.
Yeah, we're just going to milk as many wedding gifts as we can.
50 registries.
we have so many mixers. It's crazy.
I love the phrase separate but equal, because that really ties it back to an earlier civil rights movement. And it really is a civil rights issue where it was believed that, hey, as long as black people have equal facilities, they have colored bathrooms and colored water fountains. What's wrong with that? And separate but equal, as the Supreme Court ruled in a very famous decision, which was it Brown versus Board of Education, said that's not equal. Mm-hmm. Equal
right.
is equal. And so anything that is separate but equal is not the same. And this is a civil rights issue that all of us need to be aware of. And I know it doesn't agree or concur with some people's deeply held religious beliefs or other beliefs. But
it's a civil rights issue.
Rights. It's about treating people fairly.
Yeah, 1,049 federal rights depend upon marital status, right? So hospital visitation rights, insurance, inheritance laws, adoption, immigration. These are like real issues. Just filing my taxes is such a pain. We file married in California, but separately federally as domestic partners. And then I got this crazy IRS bill because the IRS doesn't even know how to deal with us because we're in this weird window of married during the time that we could. And we got kind of grandfathered in. And so it's just, it's complicated.
Yeah. I wanted to bring it up because I know it's an important part of your life. And
I appreciate that. I'm happy to talk about it.
Yeah.
Well, and Gina, what would you say to people who are like, I don't want to hear about this. I don't think this is necessary or important to talk about. And I don't like it. The people who just want to shut down and not listen and not hear about it.
That's okay with me. Then they don't have to listen to that part. I kind of approach it the same way that I approach sort of being a woman in technology. I'm not necessarily going to talk about being a feminist or being a woman all the time. I'm just going to be really good at what I do. And if you like my stuff, one day you're going to go, oh, she's in a same-sex marriage? Like, she's being, discriminated against?
Maybe I shouldn't hate her.
Like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't. Yeah. Somebody that I know is about this. But, I don't talk about it that much because it's just, I'm not an activist. I'm a technologist. Right. But for the folks that don't want to hear about it, that's cool. It's just part of who I am. And so when it comes up, I'm just matter of fact about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Gina Trapani, it's so great to talk to you. She hosts, of course, she's a regular on our network. As many times we can get her on, we will. She's a regular host on This Week in Google every Wednesday with Jeff Jarvis at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. She blogs at smarterware.org. ThinkUpApp.com is the place to go to download ThinkUp app. If you've got your own server, you do need your own server, and you're a little bit geeky, it is really a cool thing to have. I'm very, very grateful for all of the information I get from it. And when Steve Martin comes on, I'll make sure we say hi. And
basically, if you're running your own WordPress installation,
like
not WordPress.com, but WordPress.org,
you can
do it. You can.
That was our
same
goal.
Same skill set.
Yeah. That was our goal, to hit that kind of level. And also just a plug for the open source community. My goal with building the ThinkUp open source community is I want to be kind of the friendliest open source project to noobs. So if you've always kind of liked the idea of contributing to open source, but it felt too scary or too intimidating, this is a great starter project. It's PHP, which is a simple scripting language. We have had this mailing list of 600, 700 people. In 2 years, we've never had a single flame war. So I take really seriously running a respectful and friendly and helpful community around the project. So it's a great place to start. And we're looking for not just programmers, but we're looking for designers and copywriters and people who are willing willing to just look, read through documentation and let us know, you know, what reads well and what doesn't make sense. So if you ever thought about contributing to something open source, I hope you'll just check out ThinkUp for that reason alone.
And the To-Do Text program is at todotxt.com. And this is a really great way to geek out. Maybe this would be your first step, is download the command line interface, the shell script, and set it up, and you'll feel so good when you start doing your to-do list with command lines. It just feels good.
Bring back the CLI.
And be careful, because you know what? You could get sucked in. And pretty soon you might be a geek too. Gina Trapani puts a really nice face on geekery, I got to say. It's nice to be nice. Thank you, Gina, for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me today. It's been really an honor to be on the show. I love this show. It's one of my favorite Twitch shows.
Oh, yay. Thank you for being here. We do this, as I said earlier, we do it every Wednesday afternoon, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern time. So you can watch live. Do watch live, because it's always fun to watch. But if you don't, if you miss it, or you missed one of the 39 other episodes, just come back to twit.tv and search for Triangulation. And they're all there. And lots of great guests. Who's next week, Eileen Rivera? Oh, now this is exciting. Bram Cohen, who created the BitTorrent protocol and is BitTorrent.com, and has done some very interesting things. In fact, has really made it a commercial entity beyond, you know, the vision people have of it as a pirate tool.
All those people who are like, well, what else do people use BitTorrent for other than piracy and Linux ISOs? Yep. Bram Cohen will tell you.
And we're going to roll out, we're hoping, at the same time as Bram comes on, that will be our beginning of our BitTorrent live feed.
Oh,
if you've been curious, we have been planning to do a live stream using the BitTorrent P2P protocol, and details on that will be forthcoming, and Bram will be one of the first to talk about it.
Appropriately
next week,
enough.
2 weeks hence, February 22nd, I believe. We haven't absolutely confirmed it with Steve, but Steve Martin will join us, and we'll talk about his Twitter book, which he owes thanks to Gina for. Otherwise, he wouldn't have any of those tweets and replies and all of that stuff. Thanks so much, Gina. Thank you all for being here. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.